This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And is it a matter of faith at this point? Do you believe Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid? Say it, Reverend Reid.
I'm very optimistic that we will reach an agreement that's reasonable in nature this week to reopen the government, pay the nation's bills, and begin long-term negotiations to put our country on sound fiscal footing.
You can't really blame the young voices like the electronic artist Blackbird for shedding their beliefs in American institutions like the U.S. Senate and the House these days. We will give you the latest on the government shutdown and the debt ceiling crisis and all the other self-immolation going on in Washington, D.C. But we are taking on the issue of belief all week in our look at the young nation under God in America. The millennial generation, born since 1980, has a whole different set of beliefs and values and is starting to flex its muscles in American culture. A week-long look at the impact on religion in America. Today begins with a look at how millennial secular Jews see themselves carrying on and shedding traditions at the same time. But first to Washington, where Congress has until Thursday now to pass a compromise deal or risk putting the federal government into default by not raising the debt ceiling. Is the world financial system a believer in the U.S. compromisers in the Senate and House? Or are they taking steps to prepare for the worst? Today, Simon Johnson joins us, former chief economist at the IMF. Simon Johnson, are you a believer?
I believe that the U.S. will pull back from the brink. And fortunately, a lot of other people around the world seem to also share that belief.
And the brink may be less of the issue than the extent to which this kind of process erodes people's belief that the U.S. is in there for the long term and accelerates people's preparations for finding an alternative to the dollar or treasury bills, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think this encourages everyone to diversify their portfolios. The Chinese are calling for de-dollarization, and the British today are out saying that they would welcome the Chinese developing the renminbi, the Chinese currency, as an offshore currency based in London. Well, you can see where this is heading.
And the politicians in the United States who claim that the U.S. is the greatest economy in the world, that they would do something that would essentially call for a backup plan around the world. What do bankers and financiers and economists such as yourself think about that? I mean, aside from the pageantry of U.S. politics, it is completely suicidal.
It's suicidal in an economic sense, certainly, and it has already done great damage to the economy. The level of uncertainty has increased. That discourages investment, discourages consumption, it weakens the recovery. And I'm afraid that the politicians who are responsible for this form of holdup have a lot to answer for.
Is there an issue with the Federal Reserve in the sense that when they begin to taper out of the quantitative easing, the stimulus program under Janet Yellen, as we expect will be the case early next year, that there's going to be a much greater sort of snapping of the rubber band and that interest rates will rise much more quickly, especially because of this crisis that we're in right now?
Not necessarily. I think the impact of the monetary policy decisions is somewhat independent. But you can see also from what people were saying over the weekend at the IMF World Bank meetings that countries are very nervous about the way which we're going to impact them, both with the Fed tapering, when and if that comes, and with our actions on fiscal policy. It's a sort of a whipsaw for the world economy, which is entirely due to what we have got ourselves into.
And we're basically making the case that the U.S. is manipulating the world economy either through its monetary policy or this fiscal nonsense, again, encouraging people to find alternatives.
Well, I wouldn't use the word manipulation, but I think disturbing the world economy. You know, we're banging up against each other, having a bit of a fight on Capitol Hill, not realizing that every elbow knocks over somebody else's economy or, you know, pushes a couple of more million people down closer towards the poverty line. It's extreme carelessness on the part of people who do run the world's most important economy.
And let's speak for a moment about the conversation that maybe was taking place over the weekend at the IMF and the World Bank. They had their meetings with this hanging over their heads. There's been a lot of talk in Washington, particularly among Democrats, that the Republicans have enshrined this as a way of doing business continually going forward. What is the chance that, no, actually the opposite is true, that this time we're going to see that maybe they have learned their lessons and that this is not going to be something that we return to?
No, I'm afraid all the indications we're getting are that while we will likely avert disaster this week, this is going to be some form of business as usual, meaning a great deal of uncertainty damages our economy and spills over and has the worst possible effects on the rest of the world.
Does the fact that we've come close twice now mean that the U.S. default, if it does happen, say 6 months from now, that the world will be insulated from it, that we will be the only ones that suffer, and the default will have less of an impact because people have had time to prepare?
No, unfortunately, this is the kind of disaster for which you can't really prepare. This is the hurricane that's just off the scales. This is the earthquake that is beyond what you can handle with your building code. This would sweep away most financial systems and most fiscal systems around the world.
Of course, the Ron Pauls of the world say that it's all propped up by paper and smoke and mirrors to begin with, that maybe the option, if the U.S. defaults, would be for everyone to just kind of ignore it because it can't actually go away. There's no way to take the U.S. out from underpinning the global economy.
I think it's shocking to the rest of the world when they hear prominent politicians in the United States using language like that. I don't know any other country, any other prominent countries, actually most banana republics, do not have politicians who are able to talk that way freely in public and have some sort of echo chamber. It's astonishing and deeply scary.
And the effect of the default would scare them into understanding that there are tangible results, that it's not smoke and mirrors, that it's based on credit, faith, and belief, the entire global economy.
It would certainly be scary to default, but then you can't put it back. You can't say, oh, we've defaulted now, we're going to undo that next week. Once you've gone through that, as many other countries have experienced, once you have that reputation, once you've damaged those asset holdings, once the risk premium is being applied very generously to your treasury debt, that's a very different world.
Risk premium being applied to your treasury debt, meaning that the U.S. is Argentina, right?
The U.S. is Argentina, or the U.S. is Russia, or the U.S. is any other country that's been through a traumatic debt experience in the past 10 to 15 years. At the moment, we're the safe haven. Our treasury debt is regarded as the safest asset in the world. That can change, and it will change if we continue down this path.
Simon Johnson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. Caught, of course, in the middle of all this politically is the Affordable Care Act, which will apparently get some tweaks under a possible Senate-House compromise. Tweaks fall far short of repeal or wholesale delay of the Affordable Care Act, but they make some noticeable changes for people who have already taken advantage of the open enrollment period now underway, despite the government shutdown. They may delay the moment of truth for some businesses as well. Looking at the ACA's impact on them, Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for the Kaiser Health News, joins us. Mary, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So oddly here, part of the Republican compromise would seem to increase the amount of paperwork for certain individuals who might be eligible for getting subsidies. What's that all about?
Well, there's an income verification provision in this tentative deal that Congress is looking at right now that would have the head of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, the secretary of HHS, certify that everyone getting a subsidy to help purchase coverage actually is entitled to one, and the inspector general of HHS, kind of the investigative arm, would have to also audit that process. So my assumption is that it shouldn't delay any sort of implementation of the law, or the administration wouldn't have gone along with it. But this is to calm concerns from Republicans that people don't get subsidies unless they're really entitled to them.
But if people who have already signed up and who are already enrolled could see some additional questions being asked of them if they have applied for a subsidy.
Absolutely. I mean, coverage doesn't start till January the 1st. So in the income verification process, as it's established, they might have to come up with some more paperwork or other pieces of paper to show that, in fact, what their income is, that they don't get insurance from an employer. If they do, it's deemed unaffordable, and they're entitled to a subsidy to buy on the health insurance exchange.
Now, one of the really strident arguments in the House, particularly over the last several weeks, was the idea that there have been delays for certain parts of the Affordable Care Act, and this compromise adds an additional one. It seems that businesses have really been getting off sort of scot-free on some level. What's this latest reinsurance tax delay?
This is a one-year delay in an assessment of its $63 per covered person per year for 3 years that is meant to sort of even out some of the risk in the individual market. People in the individual market tend to be sicker. They tend to be costlier. So this is a fund set up to help insurers in the individual market recoup high losses if they get someone that's extremely sick. But big employers don't like this. Union plans don't like it because it doesn't benefit their members. And so this is a one-year delay, but as it's been explained to me, it's kind of an accounting shift. Instead of collecting the tax next year, it will be delayed for a year and will be collected the following 3 years, but the benefits are still paid out 2014, 2015, and 2016. So it's kind of a sleight of hand to appease employers and union groups, but nonetheless, it's, as we say in Washington, budget neutral. The money still stays the same.
And it doesn't diminish the amount of support that's going to be needed to run some of these exchanges in the individual insurer market that you've talked about can be expensive.
That's right. They can be expensive. And you've got to remember that insurers in the individual market made their bids based on the assumption this reinsurance fee would be collected and paid. So you can't really change the rules of the game at this point.
Now, the big mystery here, and, you know, you're not necessarily someone we would rely on as a political expert, and I don't ask you for the sort of cloakroom story here, but what happened to the medical device tax? That was something that was a complete deal breaker on the part of Republicans. Now, is it back in? Is it out? Where does that stand?
It appears to be out, but I've been told out for the moment. You've got to remember that the medical device tax, and again, this is a 2.3% tax levied on things like artificial hips and pacemakers and so on. This is a very organized and a very strong lobby, and they had pushed on the argument that this would hurt our research and development of medical devices and reduce jobs and so on. But when push comes to shove, you've got to remember that there are a lot of industries that have to pay new taxes and fees in the Affordable Care Act. We've just talked about the insurance industry, the prescription drug industry is paying new fees.
And let me just stop you there. On a medical device, I mean, if you have an artificial hip, why would someone not get an artificial hip because of some 2.3% tax? And wouldn't the medical manufacturer be able to pass those along?
That's the thought. They'll simply pass it along. And so that could increase the cost of the procedures when we're in an era where we want to reduce healthcare costs.
All right. Are these tweaks significant or worth all of this angst that we've been going through before we go?
Fairly minor, I think. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to see more efforts from Republicans who hate the health law to defund it.
Watching the compromise on Capitol Hill that involves the Affordable Care Act, Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So later this hour, is America turning away from God and religion? The latest data say young America is. What is the role of religion in your life and in your family? Sarah from Dallas, Texas wrote us this. I was born into an ultra-conservative right-wing Christian family, but after 19 years of overprotective sheltering, I branched out and became an atheist. I believe spirituality plays a very important role in every human's life, but religion can destroy more than it builds.
Religion's kind of weird in our family because my wife's an ordained Baptist minister with a very broad spiritual perspective, whereas I'm not a believer at all, but we get along fine and it just works out just fine.
We thank our friend Bruce for that story. He called us at 8778. My take from New Brunswick, New Jersey. As an observant Jew, religion is at the center of my life and my family. Later this hour, we'll talk to some Jewish Americans about their feelings about change and religion. You can tweet us your story using the hashtag #MyBelief. We're collecting your stories all this week on The Takeaway. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize this month, but the reward is continuing to do some of the most dangerous work on the planet. Inspectors continue to face serious roadblocks in their efforts to dismantle serious cache of chemical weapons. There are continuing access problems at chemical weapons sites in the war zone, some in the middle of battle sites, chemical weapons sites being fought over by rebel and government forces, changing hands a day at a time. More than 7 of Syria's 20 chemical weapons sites have been reached by inspectors so far. The organization has called for local short-term ceasefires in order to allow work to be completed. Joining us now is spokesman for the OPCW, Michael Lujan. Welcome back to the program, Michael.
Hi, John.
Now, I want to say congratulations, but you have used the Nobel Peace Prize, and we'll get to the Syria details in a moment, to really remind the world that this is a global responsibility. This isn't just the OPCW's kind of charitable work on behalf of the world. This is everyone's responsibility.
The Syria mission has a very powerful and robust mandate that was given to it in the form of a unanimous Security Council resolution, a decision adopted by consensus by our own policymaking organs in the OPCW. And now, of course, the moral force of the Nobel Peace Prize that we were awarded on Friday And we really do think that the combination of this, these expressions of international will is going to be tremendously helpful in generating cooperation on the ground from the various groups in Syria.
So you believe this is a unique moment in pursuing your mission, not only in Syria, but globally?
Things have come together very well, actually, and we're seeing what I think you could call encouraging progress. We're getting all the cooperation we need from the Syrian government. And there have been some instances where we've had to change plans at the last minute to visit a site here and there because the necessary security arrangements could not be ensured. But overall, yes, we are approximately on track with our timetable for this particular stage of the mission.
What are the access problems, and how do you use the authority and the new authority, as you've described it, of the OPCW, to really change the situation when Syrian forces and opposition forces are fighting amongst themselves?
Well, the issue or the responsibility for security in areas or in situations where the Syrian government's writ doesn't extend on the ground is with United Nations Department of Safety and Security. It's part of their mission in Syria and Damascus. They're the ones who have the contacts with the various rebel groups and have been quite successful and efficient in getting cooperation so far. But as I said, it hasn't been perfect. There have been some setbacks here and there. But overall, we're seeing quite encouraging progress, and we are getting out to these sites. In a few days, our Director General will be giving the first progress report on the mission to our Executive Council, after which we'll have more to say, more details to share publicly.
Now, a cynical view of Syria's actions here might suggest that entering into the Chemical Weapons Convention, which is what Syria did on Monday, is simply a way for them to gain more credibility and stall for time. How do you see the fact that Syria has signed on?
Motivations are immaterial for us. We have one single simple mission here, and that's to work with the Syrian government and other forces on the ground to allow us to get in, verify its chemical weapons stockpile, and then oversee the destruction of it in its entirety in the next 9 months. That's an enormous, enormous challenge, unprecedented. But at the same time, we're hopeful that if we get the cooperation that we need for this very specific mission of getting at and destroying serious chemical weapons, that the cooperation that that will engender on the ground among all the various parties may have a carryover effect and prove to be catalytic in restarting meaningful peace talks.
You know, among your colleagues in the, you know, granting of the Nobel Peace Prize, in aid organizations that are involved in dangerous work of this type, are landmine eradication groups that have shared the Nobel Prize in years past. And they tell a story of really receiving a heroic reception on the ground when they go in. The Nobel Peace Prize is well known. Their work is well known. I'm wondering if you have any stories of how the OPCW's officers are being received by people, ordinary citizens on the ground in Syria. I don't know if you're in a position to tell me those details, but I'm quite interested.
Well, I can say that in the areas which are within government control, we are enjoying quite free and ready access to all of the sites. And to my knowledge, our inspectors have encountered no hostility or bad feelings. I could point to that investigation, you recall, that was conducted in those suburbs of Damascus, where we gathered evidence that proved conclusively that chemical weapons had been used in that attack on 21st of August. And you've seen the video clips from that.
Yes.
The inspector team was absolutely surrounded and in a very positive, encouraging way by the local community residents who seemed to be quite happy that this international intervention had been implemented.
So you've really taken a step up as protector of the citizens in a very tangible way in Syria. Where do you go from here?
Where do we go from here? We have about 300 days of day-by-day work to go. It's, you know, we none of us here underestimate the enormous challenges and potential pitfalls of this mission. It's day-to-day in terms of negotiating access for our inspectors. One thing that's very encouraging is the amount of financial support that we are getting in the way of voluntary contributions to a special trust fund that the OPCW has set up to underwrite all of our costs in undertaking these verification activities in Syria. So as things stand right now, we can only be encouraged by the way everything has come together, the pieces are falling into place, and the progress that we're seeing on the ground.
A very upbeat report, international cooperation with real tangible results on the ground in Syria. Michael Lujan, spokesman for the Organization of the for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pressures on populations in the Horn of Africa and in Syria and Palestine have led to tragic refugee deaths at sea this month in the Mediterranean. Hundreds attempting to escape their nations in overcrowded ships, foundering in the seas around Malta on their way to Italy. Here's Maltese Colonel Mario Spiteri.
People are drowning. People, I mean, it's all this darkness is setting in. So to us, life takes priority. So we just pluck them in out of the water and ensure their safety on board. And my life, 27 years, I've never seen anything like this before.
The governor of Sicily has declared a state of emergency. Melissa Fleming is spokeswoman at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Melissa, welcome.
Nice to be here.
How often has the Mediterranean been a pathway to escape from places like Somalia and Eritrea?
Well, for some, it is actually the only route to escape and to arrive in safety in Europe. And that's the problem, because it's very often a death trap. The only way for these people to have transport is on rickety boats manned by ruthless smugglers that often end up sinking. So it's not the best route for people escaping war and violence and persecution.
What is the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees' role in protecting, say, the 350 Eritreans who died within sight of the Italian island of Lampedusa this month?
Well, in this case, it is the role of search and rescue crews. And in this case, what happened, there was a sudden fire on the boat. And the rescue attempts were courageous, and they did what they could. The problem is when you have that many people crowded onto a boat and it sinks so fast and people crammed into the under cabins, they just drown. And it's very difficult to find. They're not obviously not informing in advance of their route.
So the 300 migrants who were rescued this week, is that something that we're to chalk up to luck, pure miracle, or is the Italian Navy really getting more focused on this exodus?
There was a terrible tragedy on Friday night, and one could look at it as a rescue. 200 people were rescued, but it's estimated that there could have been at least 500 on board, and these are people fleeing from Syria. And the tragic thing is that up to about 250 are probably still missing, feared drowned. And even more tragic is when Syrians flee, they flee as families. So there were 100 kids on board and only 20 were rescued.
What are the hazards in making this passage from a place like Syria?
Well, mostly they travel to, in this case, Libya. Syrians are also taking off from Egypt. They pay smugglers large sums of money. The problem is that the boats are not seaworthy. We've heard stories of people, you know, starving to death or dying of thirst or being just given a GPS and saying that's the direction of Italy and having no crew on board.
What would you say the Italians' role here has been? A responsible one, an aggressive one, an aggressive enough one?
The Italians have done what they can. I mean, they have definitely welcomed anyone who lands, and they've rescued anyone who has gotten a signal to them in time. It's a big burden for one country. The problem is the borders of Europe right now, the land borders are closed. The sea borders are sometimes the only way for people to seek asylum.
Can the United Nations do anything to intervene in the smuggling business, take it over, overwhelm it in some way?
Well, this is something probably for international police action. And this is not a UN function, but what we can do is step up information efforts. so that people at their port of departure are much better aware of the risks that they're taking, that they're risking their lives. But of course, when those people are rescued, they shouldn't be turned back. They need to be brought to a place of safety where they can seek asylum and have a safe haven.
Speaking to us from Geneva, Melissa Fleming is spokeswoman at the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The collision of traditional values and the embrace of change. This is America's narrative in the 21st century. America, one of the nations that most frequently self-identifies as deeply religious, our politics full of invoked prayer, the hope of blessings from God, emotional debates over traditional family values, our sports figures constantly thanking God for their success. This same nation is pulling away from tradition. America's young nation under God is neither faithful nor deeply religious in practice. That's what the latest figures show. The millennials born since 1980 are driving this change, according to a Pew Foundation study. They are less likely to embrace the traditions of their parents, and one in four claim no affiliation at all, openly declare atheism or no belief when asked. And that's just the beginning. Dante Cini is the director of the American Communities Project. He joins me today. Dante, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So for millennials, religious or not, they are far less likely to embrace whatever it was their parents believed. I mean, that's the basic issue here, right?
That's true. And I would say millennials are the latest iteration of this. But I think we've seen this even going back to Gen Xers before them. There has been a gradual, over the last couple generations, walking away from religion. And millennials are further, it seems, along that path than generations before them, yeah.
And they're starting to make their sort of cultural impact known. We're going to talk about that a little bit later with some Jewish Americans about what their lives are like. But how does all of this break down by race, urban, rural? You know, you love the urban-rural thing.
I do love the urban-rural thing because it's just so clearly where there's a divide now. And when you look at the urban-rural split in the country right now, what's happened is there aren't a lot of jobs in rural America. So if you go to college, you got a chance to, you think, do something bigger, make a little more money, you head to a city. Rural America is much older than the rest of the country, and urban areas are younger. There are a lot of millennials in urban areas. And the data on this really backs this up. Rural areas, when you look at this in terms of, we have big data polls from Experian, the consumer research firm, which asks people everything, not just about where they eat and shop. But people are 25% more likely to say they are conservative evangelical Christians, 25% more likely than the nation as a whole, and obviously much more likely than that when you compare it to urban areas. And also, people in those rural areas are 20% more likely to say they enjoy watching religious television programs. So what we're talking about here, this split that's happening with millennials, I do think it's happening across the culture. But I think it's really pushing kind of metropolitan urban America further down a path that is away from rural
hey,
America.
The godless cities, isn't that what they say when you leave home and go absolutely. Make your fame and fortune? Well, one of the things that's in the data that's really interesting is the fact that even in rural areas, the religion that people ascribe to, if they're millennials, might be different from their parents. So the actual embrace of religion could be a form of rebellion in itself. The Jewish population is very, very interesting in the Pew study. The stats show that for a huge number, being Jewish is not much more than knowledge of the Holocaust and some vague idea of ethics. What's that about?
Well, this is something that's been going on for a while, right? These are people who identify themselves as being cultural Jews, right? I'm culturally Jewish, but I'm not very religious. There is always the question, and the poll makes this point, that this is where these people are now. Is this where they're going to be 10 years from now? A lot of times religion, a more kind of standardized version, more formal version of religion, is something you come to later in life, something when you have children and you want to kind of get the values that were put into you, inculcated into them. But we'll have to wait and see. I mean, this difference between saying you're a strict adherent to a religion and being a cultural follower of something, it's a Jewish phenomenon. But it's also, you see it among Catholics. There are people who call themselves cultural Catholics.
And it's a kind of a sleeper cultural phenomenon. I mean, it's possible, and members of the clergy do say this, that as time goes on, as you pass milestones in your life, those cultural traditions may become more religious. Dante Cini, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dante Cini is director of the American Communities Project at American University.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at lumosity.com.
The Roberts Supreme Court gets another chance at a milestone of legal doctrine, clarifying the constitutionality of affirmative action. In last year's case, Fisher versus the University of Texas, the school's racial criteria were not struck down, but the court sidestepped the chance to rule on the overall constitutionality of race-based diversity criteria in higher education. Today's case takes the issue back to Michigan to hear a challenge of a ballot measure passed by a majority of voters in 2006 which bans race-based affirmative action in state colleges and university admissions. The court has already ruled in previous cases that affirmative action is permissible in certain limited cases, but this case forces the court to declare if racial criteria in college admissions must be an option available for colleges for the protection of the rights of minorities. Richard Friedman is professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Now, you've really lived this issue and these cases throughout your time on the faculty at U of M.
That's right. I was a member of the faculty when we adopted the policy that was at stake in one of the 2003 cases, Grutter v. Bollinger.
And Grutter v. Bollinger, am I right in saying that the outcome of that case was to suggest that it's permissible to use race-based criteria and that this case, also back in Michigan, would look at the issue from the completely different side?
Yes, this case puts it in an entirely different light. What we did was we used what was called a holistic approach. That is, we looked at the entire file of the applicant, and race was one factor in the consideration. And the court held that that was permissible for diversity purposes. What the undergraduate admissions program did, there were two cases at the same time. They had a point system, and the court held that was no good. So many universities have adopted systems like ours, but then the people of Michigan adopted this constitutional amendment to the state constitution, prohibiting universities from doing what we were doing.
How much different is it in terms of legal proof and the kinds of arguments that you would use before the court to say, on the one hand, the Grutter case, that is the formula that you use at the University of Michigan is permissible versus these kind of formulae need to be protected as a constitutional matter so that schools have the option to use them? That's a completely different argument.
Well, it's a totally different case, right? Nobody is contending seriously that universities have to have an affirmative action program. The question here is sometimes called referred to as political restructuring. The argument is that by adopting a state constitutional amendment, the people of the state have made it more difficult for those who want to have a race-based affirmative action program to get it implemented, more difficult than, say, those who want to have alumni preferences or preferences for people from the from the Upper Peninsula. So this case is not going to discuss the constitutional validity of affirmative action. That's kind of taken as a given, as you said, limited circumstances.
But this does decide whether a ban like this unfairly targets racial groups because of the impermissibility now within the state of using these criteria by schools.
That's right. The argument is that it's a selective restructuring of the political system, that that others who want to get preferences and admissions can do it by persuading the Board of Regents. But now those who want to get a race-based affirmative action program have to get a state constitutional amendment.
All right. So we've been talking some legalese here.
Yeah.
Let me just step way back and just as just General Joe Citizen here. If I'm concerned about affirmative action, the idea that there will be racial criteria used in various aspects of American life to bring people into the opportunities that all of us enjoy in the U.S. Does this case have a clear impact on me, or is it way, 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 way down in the details of a doctrine that's mostly settled?
No, I think it clearly could have an impact. Until the people of the state adopted Proposition 2, we had continued doing what we'd been doing before, and then we had to stop. And several other states, California was the first, and I believe there are several others.
There's California, Washington, Arizona, Nebraska, Oklahoma,
yeah,
all of them.
That's right. So there are several states that that have statewide bans like this. If those are invalidated, then presumably universities in those states, some universities anyway, will resume affirmative action programs.
So then
we certainly would if we were allowed.
So then in terms of the Roberts Court, your view of it, is this a 5-4 states' rights divide or a 5-4 sort of racial preferences?
I don't think of it as a states' rights thing so much. It's really a question of whether the people of the state can make this decision wholesale. And I don't think it's necessarily going to be a 5-4 decision either.
And so
not everything is 5-4.
Right, that is true. And we've learned that and been surprised by that. Is this a federalism decision?
Well, I think it's sort of a democratic process decision, really. I think the question is whether the people of the state can make this decision and say, you know what, this is not a matter of process. We have the option of allowing affirmative action in universities, and we don't want to do it. And that's, of course, the way the Solicitor General of the state will present it, that this is not a restructuring of the political process. This is the political process having worked very well. And it came to an outcome that the plaintiffs don't like. So that's going to be their view, and I wouldn't be surprised if it commands a substantial majority of the court.
A substantial majority of the court in favor of the challenge?
In favor of the state.
Favor of the state.
Yeah.
All right. Richard
yeah.
Friedman, professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School on the latest affirmative action case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
What you believe will not be the beliefs of your children and grandchildren. What your parents believed is not what you believe. In America's churning culture of rebellion and assimilation, we understand this intuitively. But as we've seen this hour, since 1980, religions in this country are seeing assumptions about who is and isn't part of the faithful challenged or repudiated. Is there a young nation under God in America? For the estimated 5 million Jews living in this country, there may be a deep shift in identity going on right now. New Pew Research data for the post-1980 generation who were raised Jewish, only 68% identify as Jews by religion, while 32% describe themselves as having no religion, even if they claim Judaism through ancestry, ethnicity, or culture. Michael Yashinsky is a 24-year-old millennial who grew up in a conservative Jewish household in the suburbs of Detroit.
I'm just as likely to read the story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible as I am to read a story by Isaac Babel, the Russian Jewish writer, and get as much inspiration from one as I do from the other. Because really, Judaism is not only a religion and it's not only a culture, it's everything, really. It's a civilization.
Sarah Seltzer, 32 years old, works at the National Council for Jewish Women.
I'm an atheist, but I do believe in the power of ritual and prayer, and I go to shul. I don't go every single Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, but I do go, and I do the confession of sins and asking God for forgiveness.
Adam Chandler, 31 years old, grew up in a Reform Jewish family in Houston, Texas.
I'm a staff writer at Tablet Magazine, which is a very Jewish magazine, but among my friends, I'm also known as the guy who makes really great breakfast tacos with bacon in them. There's a certain kind of split there.
What do these three have in common? A lot. We began with their strong views about how Israel's religious authorities have often attempted to define Jewish practice around the world.
I'd say that probably these Jews in Israel that you talk about, these very observant Jews, they realize that a Jew is a Jew. They may be somewhat lapsed in their observance of Jewish law, but I think they would still accept us as Jews and embrace us. You have to realize that Jews are now and have always been a collection of so many disparate types.
So tradition strong as far as you're concerned, Michael. Sarah, how about you?
I agree. I think that it's very important to have a sense of Jewishness. I think that secular Jews have existed probably since the beginning of Judaism. So I think that a lot of this hand-wringing over Jews leaving the fold and being lapsed, I think, is a bit misplaced. And I also think it doesn't take the sort of current context into account. I mean, this generation are finding so many interesting creative ways to be Jewish, whether it's through cultural exploration or through all the Jewish publications. I really, really believe that embracing that rather than sort of casting it away is the key to the survival of Jews, particularly in America.
And how about you, Mr. Bacon?
I absolutely agree with that. I think the pronouncements that are made about the decline or, you know, the failings of modern, young, secularish Jews is it's a problem because it's shutting people away from the community, which is ultimately the wrong thing
to
do.
It's sort of self-defeating and self-fulfilling prophecy almost.
But I wonder, there was one thing that was troubling about that Pew survey, I think. There was one statistic I read that a large percentage of Jews believe that their main manifestation of their Jewishness is their sense of humor. And, of course, a lot of people have a sense of humor. It's got to be something more uniquely Jewish than that. That can't be what makes you Jewish. So a lot more people said that than those who said that their observance of Jewish custom or law makes them Jewish.
Seinfeldians. That's what we would call the American Jews.
Yeah, and I'd say that Judaism may not have a great chance of sticking around for thousands of years if, you know, the main thing that makes people Jewish today is a heightened appreciation of Seinfeld. There's got to be something more. There's got to be something deeper, I think.
I definitely agree with that, but I also sense the way that culturally people who grew up Jewish or who are Jewish, even if they don't say they're Jewish or by name are Jewish or by birth are Jewish, sort of chronicle the experiences of living in a community, and a lot of it's manifested through humor. Acts as a portal for other people to look into the community and understand all of the ways that it functions and also dysfunctions and sort of sees the humanity in it. And I don't think there's anything terribly wrong with that sort of understanding of Jewish culture because there's something underneath it.
I'm wondering if, and this is, I think, relatively unique to the Jewish experience, certainly as compared to Christianity. If all of you, despite your various practices and various sense of having moved away from tradition, have within you a kind of, in case of deep emotional tragedy or experience, break glass, and you essentially buy it all, that you can imagine yourself in the deepest sort of traditional Jewish ceremony as a reaction to a personal crisis of one kind or another, and that you could go there even if today you don't agree with what the Hasidics are doing over here and the Orthodox are doing over here and the Reforms are doing over here. Michael?
I'd say I can't foresee an emotional crisis like that happening. God forbid, I shouldn't like an emotional crisis to happen. But probably something else in my life might change, namely maybe marrying and raising children, which I hope will happen. And that, I think, will necessarily change my Jewish practice because as a father, as a husband, I would like to be, I think, a model of what it is to be a Jew in the world and what it is to be a learned Jew and a grounded Jew and also a spiritually yearning Jew, trying to be better, trying to be more connected. So I'd say probably my practice would firm up maybe and be even deeper as I grow up, I think.
I have 5 kids, Michael. Believe me, sometimes it does feel like a spiritual crisis. But go ahead, Sarah.
I do to an extent. Jewish morning rituals are really important to me. I mean, I think that the Kaddish is something that even the most secular Jew might come back to because it connects us to all the losses in our past and in our future. And it's this really beautiful, sad thread that connects us. But my feminism is in sort of direct contrast with that deep, deep practice of Judaism. And I think that there's always going to be a part of me. Even when I became a bat mitzvah, I was up there on the podium complaining about Orthodox sexism. So that's sort of like a huge part of who I am. And I think that I could never sort of break glass and go all the way in. But I definitely think that I could turn to more ritual and more Judaism. But I can't ever sort of see myself going to a rabbi. I'd rather go to a therapist, and I think that's very cultural, modern Jew of me.
Adam?
You know, I spent my freshman year a gap year in between high school and college in Israel when the Second Intifada broke out there. And, you know, we were a lot of sheltered American kids living in Israel and away from our parents for the first time. And, you know, I remember there was a certain importance that was placed on community gatherings, especially on Shabbat, to sort of be together in a specific moment as a community. The next year, I started my freshman year at school in Washington, D.C., and 3 weeks into my freshman year, September 11th happened. And so I remember in the weeks after, we were doing sort of different outreach efforts between not only Jewish community and other religious communities, but within the groups that normally didn't draw that many people to Shabbat services or to events. People were coming out, and I felt that the community is always going to be there, even if one night it's 15 people and another night it's 50.
And there is great comfort in that. I can see it in your face. Yeah. Well, Adam, Sarah, and Michael, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
My name is Barbara Fishlowitz-Leong. I'm calling from Honolulu, Hawaii. We are Jewish, not just through matzo balls and challah, but also through belief, faith, and observance. Shalom and aloha.
What is the role of religion in your family? Is there a generational gap that you're experiencing? Give us your story at 877-8MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet using the hashtag MyBelief. And tomorrow we'll hear from young Muslim Americans experiencing some of the same departure from the faith of their parents. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Have a little faith in me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.